Howdy do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations podcast. It is Thursday, March 7th, 2019. I am your host, Kelly Gamott. With me today, I have Brian Chaffin. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Kelly. Good to be here.
Also with me today, I have Andrew Orr. Hi, Andrew.
Good afternoon.
And unfortunately, well, good news, bad news, I suppose. Our first topic today is why we have Andrew back on the show, and that's because of Facebook.
Yeah, maybe it's a bad afternoon.
Difficult to say, but go ahead and take us through the latest move from Facebook.
Yeah, so yesterday, Mark Zuckerberg wrote this very long essay on the future of Facebook and how he swears they're going to make it more private this time.
And no,
it's
really.
It's going to be built around... Yeah, no, really. So he mentioned different principles that it will be built around, such as encryption, messages and stories becoming more temporary, kind of like Snapchat, more interoperability, and then more private interactions.
And by interoperability, what he means is that we only want to have to go one place to snoop on people, whether you're using Facebook or Instagram or WhatsApp. Which may be a really cynical take, but that's kind of how it feels, because I know that was part of why the Instagram founders left Facebook, was because they said this was a thing that he was going to do and they didn't want to do it, and so they decided they needed to leave over it.
I don't think snooping is the right word, because people willingly give Facebook all this data.
That's true.
What Facebook does is collect it and hoard it and parse it and chop it up and slice it and dice it and then sell access to you based on that.
Right.
Based on all that information. So I don't think snooping is the right verb.
Okay. That's true. I could have probably used a better word, but what's your take on this, Brian?
LOL, Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, give me a break, dude. Like, seriously. here's one of the headlines I saw. I'm pulling it up here. Was Business Insider's take, which was that Mark Zuckerberg paints a biting contrast between Facebook and Apple on privacy, saying his company has sacrificed business to protect users. Like, in what? So, like, in what alternative universe is that even vaguely? I mean, give me, like, oh my, like, seriously, man. I mean, like, like, put down the crack pipe. I mean, because,
well, now I'm just confused by Business Insider, because obviously it's not losing Apple business. And I don't understand, you know, like, it's losing us, you know, like, in trying to compare and contrast with Apple, like, I don't understand the comparison, because I'm very lost by that. But, so you know, but you got to put Apple in the headline or nobody will click on it.
Because one of the things that Zuckerberg wrote was, and I'm quoting, "That's a trade-off we're willing to make. I think it's important for the future of the internet and privacy that our industry continue to hold firm against storing people's data in places where it won't be secure." And that's probably a shot at Apple for Apple complying with Chinese law requiring Chinese consumer data to be held in China on, you know, on a company that is co-owned by a Chinese company that is really owned by the Chinese government. So, and I guess Facebook, I guess that's what he means by, having sacrificed business. But to be fair, that's a real easy sacrifice for Facebook to make, in that China doesn't allow Facebook, and then Facebook never got any kind of real foothold in China to begin with. So, you know,
yeah.
Brave sacrifice, sir.
I mean, use the word sacrifice very carefully, in my opinion, because they tried to enter China. They couldn't. China didn't want them in the country because they already have this huge social network that everyone already uses called WeChat.
Because I was just going to say, because everybody's on WeChat, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And that, like, it, looking at what Facebook has done over the years, I think they want to be like the Western WeChat. They mm-hmm. want everything to be built into like one or two products that they own.
Mm-hmm.
And
we want your,
just didn't want the competition.
Yeah. We want your text. We want your pictures. We want your location. So please check in on Facebook whenever you go places. We want you to be able to pay people because there's some sort of Facebook payment system. They keep telling me I've got like 10 cents or something, and mm-hmm. on and on and on. So yeah, like I think they're aspiring to be WeChat, but don't have the backing of the governments and all these other places.
Yeah. So Alex Stamos, who is Facebook's former security chief, cybersecurity chief, I guess, said that this letter was a massive shot across Tim Cook's bow. Expect to hear a lot about iCloud in China every time Cook is sanctimonious. To which I say, Mr. Stamos, you can go shove that up your dark place.
Take several seats, Mr. Stamos. Yeah, that's... How is that a shot at anything or... anybody? I mean
the China thing. Apple capitulated to China's demand
that
iCloud data be stored in Chinese servers. Apple capitulated. Google, when Google was faced with something different, which was being forced to comply with the Great Wall of China censorship mm-hmm. laws, Google pulled out of China.
That's
which
true.
Was a very I've given Google kudos for that from day one. Mm-hmm. Microsoft did not. Microsoft said, yeah, sure. No worries. We'll do it. We got your back. And this was under Steve Ballmer.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say we got your back, that was like, you know, to the Chinese government. And Apple also capitulated. Apple mm-hmm. agreed to hold its data. Now Apple says that it's in charge of those servers, but you know, the reality is that when the servers are under someone else's physical control, they own those servers.
Yeah.
Whoever's got that physical control of those servers.
Yeah. This so, falls pretty squarely under possession is 9/10 of the law, just like physical access is
still
9/10 of a lot of habit.
There's still a massive difference between your business model being not predicated on invading everyone's privacy and your business model being predicated on invading everyone's privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. like, Facebook gets no moral high ground here. Zero moral high ground here. Mm-mm. Zero, zero, zero. And yeah, I'm pleased with Mr. Stamos' comment, and I'm unpleased with Mark Zuckerberg's delusional reality here.
Mostly, I'm a little disappointed in Stamos' comment, and the reason for that is because before he decided to slap a sanctimonious label on Tim Cook, he seemed like a pretty reasonable dude in a lot of respects. Like, this is what was happening at Facebook. I'm here to tell you all about it because it was ridiculous and terrible and people need to know. And so that's what I'm doing. And I'm here to tell you about it. And he seemed in the interviews I've read with him and the video I've seen of him talking about Facebook and stuff, like, he seemed like he was a pretty fact-based dude, pretty reasonable person to listen to. And so then he comes out and says something like this, and it just makes me doubt some of the other stuff that he has said. Like, were you really portraying things to us as they should be if this, you know, if the first word that you need to use to describe Tim Cook is sanctimonious?
Yep.
So mostly yep. I'm just disappointed because he had a lot of interesting stuff to say, and I listened to it and thought it was interesting to hear him say it. And now I'm not so sure that he's got a lot of cred if this is how he's going to characterize people going forward. So how about you, Andrew? I would like if you would share with us the title of the piece you wrote about this essay over at Mac Observer.
Yes. Let's see. What was it? That ominous figure standing in the corner of your digital living room is Mark Zuckerberg. Because that's how Mark described Facebook under this new vision. He wants the company to be your digital living room where you can feel safe, that you can share your thoughts and photos and messages and not have to worry, hopefully, about them collecting them for advertising.
Well, Well, nobody can do that now because they all have an Echo unit in their living room.
That's their business model.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's something
that's what they do.
Yeah. And of course, he didn't address that in his essay. It was all about privacy. He didn't mention anything about if they will change their data collection.
Right. Or if anything that they're doing is going to go to advertisers, or if any of that data is going to continue to be mined. None of that was in there. Because it would cause them to have a fundamentally different business model. And so I feel like this essay is something that we probably ought to just file under the move fast, break things thing that we see, you know, was always Facebook's motto, move fast and break things. Like, he's just trying to move fast and doesn't really care if it breaks anything or not. And honestly, it doesn't feel like this is going to make any sort of material change. Like, I want to feel like, yes, it will. But
this isn't moving fast. This is like waving your hands real fast and hoping that people think that you're moving. I mean, you know, and to wit, Facebook's stock is down 1% today. You know, if anyone took this seriously, Facebook's stock would be down 50% today.
Mm-hmm.
Or you know, more reasonably 10% today. Because that, you know, what Andrew's described is a fundamentally different Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, honest, this is going to sound weird, but I'm surprised that there was any change to the stock price at all, only because this just seems like another Zuckerberg said a thing, and, you know, and everybody kind of shrugs about it because it doesn't really matter what he says because they're not doing anything fundamentally differently or doing anything material to cause these things to happen. You know, once Facebook's privacy policy gets updated, or once the terms of service on Facebook get updated, or something else happens, you know, and a bunch of advertisers come out and complain that Facebook isn't giving them all the data that they've become accustomed to, then maybe it's a thing that we can pay attention to. But at this point, it just sort of feels like he shot his mouth off again and nobody cares what he has to say. Like, yep, from here, I feel like maybe that's why it's only been 1%. Like, there's a teeny bit of movement, and, you know, maybe it's down because the weather in New York is bad today, and so now it's down. I mean, there are certainly far flimsier reasons for stock prices to fluctuate. So that's the thing I sort of wonder about, is if that's why it's not making a more significant impact on the price.
Yeah.
Because this sort of sounds like nobody cares what he has to say. And I feel like that's way more telling than his 3,000 words worth of "no, really, privacy we mean at this time." But that could just be me having a hot take. It's hard to say.
Just give us Facebook Premium, where we pay like $1 or $2 a month. And on that paid tier, we won't see ads, or we won't have our data collected.
A massive decrease in Facebook's revenues. They make more than that on us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'd have to pay probably $200 or $300 a year.
I mean, they could still have a free tier. Like, I'm not saying you just throw that away, but just have an optional one that people can pay into, knowing that they're a little bit more private.
I like that idea. Right. Look for Andrew's new article later this week about the way a Facebook paid tier would work for people who have to be on Facebook for all of their family updates and but don't want Facebook to give everybody else in the world their information. All right, let's go ahead and move on. As always, when we have more to say about Facebook, and inevitably we will, you will hear it here. And in the meantime, I would like to talk to you about our sponsor today. Our sponsor today is Keeps. And Keeps is the easiest and most affordable way to keep the hair you have. 2 out of 3 men will experience hair loss by the time they're 35. And Keeps has FDA-approved products that used to cost a lot, but now they're inexpensive and easy to get. for 5 minutes and as little as $10 a month, you never have to worry about hair loss again. Getting started with Keeps is really easy. You sign up, you answer some questions, and you snap some photos of your hair. A licensed physician will review that information and then recommend the right treatment for you based on your information. And then that treatment gets shipped straight to you every 3 months. Keeps offers generic versions of the only two FDA-approved hair loss products out there. Some people have probably tried them before, but you've never been able to get them at this price. Keeps is between $10 and $35 a month, and right now you can get your first month free. Here's how. To get that free month of treatment, go to keeps.com/TDO. That's KEEPS.com/TDO, and you get that free month of treatment. Now, our other topic today is an interesting article about Guy Kawasaki, who people may remember from Apple as chief evangelist, and he wrote a book called Art of the Start, which I know a lot of people have enjoyed, and he's written other books too, but I know a lot of people refer to him for Art of the Start, and he's up to some interesting stuff now. Brian, you want to talk about it?
Sure. It was John Martellaro that spotted this, and I was really hoping John could talk about it, but turns out he's got some other podcasts to do, and so I am going to be a stand-in. But the thing that the thing that John honed in on was came under this section. So this is basically a profile in Forbes on Mr. Kawasaki. And this thing that that John honed in on is that this point, I guess these are like three principles that Mr. Kawasaki said he learned from working with Steve Jobs. Mm-hmm. First is, and this is the one, your current customers can't tell you how to create a revolution. They're just going to tell you how to make better, cheaper, faster, whatever they have from you already. And I completely agree with this. Tim Cook talked about this over and over again, you know, things like, you know, how will customers know what we want until we show them, mm-hmm. you know, various things like that. And, this is a very excellent point, and it is one of the things that has always differentiated Apple from its competitors, in that Apple has not been a consumer marketing driven company. It's always been driven by what is driving the executives. At least it was under Steve Jobs. I don't know how much that has changed. I don't think that has changed too much. In fact, I would say that I would also like Apple to continue to also make better, cheaper, faster Macs. But that's beside the point. That's maybe I'm just, you know, it's a little side tangent there.
That but would be cool.
I want the better, cheaper, faster in addition to the things I don't know that I want yet, mm-hmm. until the things that I think I want today are utterly replaced.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what Apple has done in the past, and that's fine. That's lovely and dandy. And I would like that. But this was one of the principles that the Guy Kawasaki took from working with Steve Jobs. Two is the design counts. It's not just functionality. People care about design. I think that we have seen Apple prove that for decades now.
Yeah.
And the last one is that you should hire people who are better than you because it should be a source of pride. I don't actually like this characterization, but because it should be a source of pride when you look around the room and the people you've hired are all better than you at what they do. That to me seems like the message is actually being misinterpreted by the interpreter, which would be the Forbes writer, mm-hmm. because you can't do all the things.
Right.
So, I mean,
that's why you hire someone else to do it, because you need somebody to do that job better than you can do that job. So right. You hire someone else for it.
Guy Kawasaki's comment was, or his version of this is to hire people who are better than you, not worse than you, and people who have different skill sets, not the same skill set, because you need people to complement you, not to duplicate you. Mm-hmm. But if you are going to hire someone to duplicate you, try to make them better than you.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. It's an interesting take. You know, Guy Kawasaki was a big part of... He was the first Mac evangelist, mm-hmm. and he was came into that role when Steve Jobs was not at Apple, and he is a big reason why Mac people became, you know, Mac people.
Yeah.
You know, things like the Evangelist and other things where you know, journalists who were being unfair to Apple or wrong about Apple were, you know, targeted. Guy would say, "Go get him."
Yeah.
You know, he'd point it out and tell him to go get him and stuff like that. That's a big part of the Mac identity, and it persisted long after Steve Jobs came back and terminated that position.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently he offered a different position to Guy, and Guy said no and regrets it, by the way.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was an interesting part of the article.
So did Guy basically create Apple fanboys?
Yes. I would say that, yeah. 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 Or at the very least, he
fanned that flame, I would say. Yeah,
he fanned that flame. His job was to whip up the evangelistic spirit. And, you know, mm-hmm. every company that has any kind of evangelist today is in one way or another modeling that off of what Guy did at Apple.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And that was and he came up, you know, sort of at the time that the internet was getting more prevalent for people. So there was an email list. That's what Brian's talking about, the evangelist, because list was in all caps on the evangelist. And you would get email, and, you know, you would get these emails that were, you know, he would be like, here's an article that's really terrible, and you could put a link to it online, which, you know, people didn't used to have that option. And you could go send an email to that, you know, whoever editor publication, and here's what's wrong with that article or whatever, and gave people an opportunity to sort of band together and find other people who wanted to talk about Apple stuff and talk about the Mac and have those conversations with other people. And it was one of the first concrete examples of somebody being able to go online and find their tribe, sort of. And, you know, I'm the only Mac user in my city, in my school, at my job, whatever, and finding other people who could talk to you about, like, yeah, you know, the new system update, don't install it, it does a weird thing if you have any audio software installed, or it doesn't work right with Photoshop yet, or, you know, like, you could get some of that information as well. But it was a lot of community, and it was one of the first opportunities to have that anywhere.
This was at a time when Apple was beleaguered at best, and, you know, like, headed towards bankruptcy.
This is Wired magazine cover era Apple. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that whole rooting for the underdog thing, which I've talked a lot about, the fact that sites like ours, like the Mac Observer and the other sites, the other Mac sites that have been around for, you know, 20 plus years, that we all started off in that era of rooting for the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And in its transitioning away from that being a thing, that is why a lot of Mac sites have fallen by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
By which I mean, I'm patting ourselves on the back for having survived.
Still being here.
And thrived.
So, and then, like, the other thing that, so that was an interesting, slice of time, as we all sit here and tell Andrew stories about back in the day, but another part of it was, like, there wasn't a lot of opportunity, and Guy Kawasaki seized on that, particularly, like, with online, which at that point mostly meant you had an email address, because there wasn't a lot of there was no social media, there was barely websites for most people, and it, like, everything that you did, you basically did through email a lot of the time, and maybe IRC. Yeah, I swapped that sound out immediately, and I had David Letterman go, "You got mail, Sparky," and that was mine. I wish I still had that sound file somewhere. I would make it my email noise again. So part of what was interesting to me about finding out what Guy Kawasaki's up to these days is that he just keeps going and building companies, or being part of getting a company to that next place. So he was part of AllTop, which is, like, a topic index for different things that you want to learn about online. It was sort of Reddit-y in that way of, like, being the front page of the internet, but kind of an interesting thing. He was involved with Canva in some capacity, the online image editing software.
Oh, nice.
I'm not sure what else he's done. I only like marginally know about those things because I don't follow him super duper closely. But I have read some of his books. I read The Macintosh Way more years ago than I'm ready to admit.
I really enjoyed The Art of Social Media by him.
Yeah, The Art of Social Media is a really good one.
Really, really good social media tips. Yeah.
And he did
not just for marketing people, I might add.
Yeah. And Art of the Start, the one I mentioned when we talked about him in the first place. I know loads of people who the thing that's interesting to me about like this book in particular is that everyone I know who read it, there's some piece of it that really resonated with them. And for everybody I know who talks about this book, it's a different piece. So for some people it was, oh, it's this thing. And another person says, oh, it was this thing. And it's always a different part of the book, which is interesting if you're looking to build a company. I thought that was also a good read. And part of the reason that there's an interview with him on Forbes right now is because he has another book out or about to come out. And I think he's doing press for that, which is how he ended up talking to Forbes. And but he's an interesting dude and he's got some interesting perspective on stuff. And part of that is because, you know, he did work at Apple without Steve. He did work at Apple with Steve. And some of that, I think, I think Apple was a huge influence on him going forward, like just the culture there and everything and being able to go forward with that over time. So yeah, Andrew, you might have homework. Sorry about that.
And he also mentions in this article that he says, or he believes there are only three true visionaries in the history of American business.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Jobs, Walt Disney, and Elon Musk.
I would have to put, though, I like those three for his list, but I would also have to include Henry Ford.
Yeah.
Rightly or wrongly, Henry Ford had an astounding vision.
Yes.
That is very difficult for anyone who, you know, hasn't studied that time of business and manufacturing, you know, that you might not be aware of. And don't get me wrong, Henry Ford had a lot of problems, just like Steve Jobs.
To put it mildly.
And just like Walt Disney.
But one thing that I think is interesting is like when Steve Jobs would talk about Apple, for example, he would say, like, you know, giving the customer something they didn't even know they wanted. And, you know, one of the things I like you, Brian, I would have said I would add a number four of Henry Ford. And, you know, and part of that is because, like, you know, Henry Ford said, if I asked my customers what they wanted, they would say faster horses. Which I feel like is a similar theory to what Steve Jobs. You can draw a pretty straight line between those two, I think. And
yeah, for sure.
I think that, so that was the thing I thought was interesting is I was like, really? Because I want to know what it is he thinks about Elon Musk being such a visionary, because so far I'm not seeing a whole lot of what Elon Musk does that affects a lot of people's everyday lives, regular folks' everyday lives. If I could go get a $90,000 car, that's one thing.
We do not have time to get into this, but that is just a ridiculous sentiment.
Okay.
Calling a spade here.
All I said was I don't see it. I didn't say it wasn't there, and I didn't say he was wrong. I just said I don't see it. Like, I see what Walt Disney has. I see the stuff that Walt Disney did. I see the stuff that Steve Jobs did. I see the stuff that Henry Ford did. I have evidence of Henry Ford's impact in my driveway right now. And
yeah, we don't have time to get into it.
That's all. So,
we don't have time to get into it.
All right.
After the show.
Yeah. Apparently, Brian's going to take me to business visionary school when we're done with the show. So, apparently, I have an appointment. So, I'm going to go ahead and call it there. I wanted to go ahead and thank both of you for coming today. Brian, thanks for being here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you sound super jazzed about it now. And Andrew, thanks for coming by.
Yep, thanks for having me.
And I've been your host, Kelly Gamont. This is the Mac Observer Daily Observations podcast. If you have an opportunity, swing by iTunes and leave us a review. I will talk to all of you tomorrow. In the meantime, be excellent to each other.